The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, we meet one of the UK's leading screen actors, star of The Da Vinci Code and Master and Commander, Paul Bettany, who's back in British indie film Broken Lines. And Guardian film critic Zam Brooks will be along to help me review some of the week's other big releases, including Lars von Trier's Melancholia, starring Kirsten Dunst, Helen Mirren is in The Debt, and Kevin Smith goes south in Red State. It's a cult listen. This is Film Weekly from The Guardian. Paul Bettany is among the A-list of British actors who straddle Hollywood blockbusters and European art house, seemingly effortlessly. From his work in Dogville with Lars von Trier to his parts in films such as The Da Vinci Code, A Beautiful Mind and A Knight's Tale, he's an actor that exudes on-screen charisma, a leading man with the dexterity of a character actor. This week, Paul is back on home turf, starring in a small independent British film called Broken Lines.
Chester.
All right, mate.
What?
I don't believe it. I've come around your yard so many times. I'm starting to get para. Thinking you was ignoring me or something.
No.
How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah. You look good.
Yeah. Right, Tony. Look who's here.
And I'm thrilled to welcome Paul Bettany to the Film Weekly studio for the first time. Normally I go out and find you, but this time you've come to me.
I have. That's because you're so powerful now.
I just had to thank you, and you're here. But it is brilliant to see you. Brilliant to see you in a low budget UK movie as well. Is it the sort of thing that you miss doing?
Yeah, it is, and it's this movie and another movie I made recently called Margin Call, which is coming out in October, I believe. Which we shot. It has Stanley Tucci, it has Kevin Spacey, Jeremy Irons, Simon Baker, Zachary Quinto, and we shot that in 17 days. And it was those two films have really been responsible for a change in me, I think, and a sort of reawakening of and a remembering the reasons I first wanted to become an actor.
And that's great to hear from my point of view, because it means that you might be here more. It means that we'll see more of you, I think.
I really think so. I hope so. I hope people will employ me. But I suddenly realised I'm just done making movies I don't care about. I can't
Is it the whole process of it? Is it getting involved with a big Hollywood machine that you can't do? The trailers are too big, or you don't feel you have any input into the part?
No, the trailers are delicious.
Because you're quite a big lad. You need a big trailer.
I need a big trailer. And it's much more to do with there's a purity of intent, you know, that is absolutely aside from, you know, the result. But there's a purity of intent in some of these things that it's really hard to find nowadays. You know, movies are, you know, studio movies, they're making less and less movies for adults,
yeah,
and more movies for kids. And that is getting tiring.
Yeah, because you managed it when you were sort of on the way up, not that you're on the way down.
Yeah.
You're on your own path now, but on the way up, I mean, Knight's Tale was a big movie. Master and Commander was a big movie.
Yeah.
Beautiful Mind was a big studio picture.
Sure,
maybe one of the last kind of grown-up studio
there
pictures.
There you go. I've been thinking about that a lot. Could Ron Howard make a movie about a mathematician with schizophrenia today? I'm not sure he could. Could Peter Weir make $100 million art movie about two guys playing the violin and the cello together? I mean, could he? I don't. I find it hard to imagine that he could.
Yeah, I mean, they're still trying. I mean, Ron Howard did do Frost Nixon. I think it was much smaller
affair.
And Peter recently did The Way Back as well. Yeah. But there was no water and boats. He did it all on dry land.
Yes, and it's
cheaper.
It's a much smaller financial endeavor. Just it seems to me that studios just aren't willing to risk that.
Is it the stars' fault then that they demanded so much money that in the end they've stopped making, they've even stopped using stars anymore? Look at all the superhero movies this summer. The main characters were fairly unknown actors, from Captain America to Thor,
right,
all the way through. Who got too big?
I really don't know, but I think when you make a movie, you spend years writing it. You're in development for years. Then you are in pre-production. Finally, it's been green lit. You spend 6 months in pre-production. Then you spend 6 months making the movie, and then you spend a year editing it. And then you take it to a theater outside San Diego and show it to 13-year-old boys and ask them their opinion. And based on their answers, change your movie. You're never gonna come up with anything fresh, because if you ask 1,000 teenagers what they think of a movie, they'll say it should be more like Underworld.
Yeah,
that's okay, but you know, should we be making just endless movies that are, you know what I'm saying?
So. That's sort of what's happening in the business. Has that happened to you? Is there a direct incident that happened to you and you went, oh no, that's not what I wanted to do?
That happens all the time. Mm. I mean, all the time in you know, greater or lesser way, you know, degrees or but I don't know, I just can't do it. It's not noble. I just can't do it any longer.
Yeah, I mean, there was a moment when you said you had, the thing is that you don't need to do it is what I thought, not because you're financially stable or whatever, it's that you are a good actor, it's great to see you on screen, you will work, you just don't have to work inside that big system. Is it hard to sort of say to, maybe it's an agent that you have to say to, maybe it's your bank manager, do you know what, I don't want to do those big movies anymore. I don't want those kind of $5 million paychecks. I'm happy to go home. $500,000 paycheck.
I'll do anything for $5 million.
Suddenly, he's back.
I'm back. Yeah, no.
Superhero Paul Bettany.
Forget that. Forget what I said. Everything before. $5 million. It's got less to do with the Hollywood system and rather more to do with a sort of shrinking of the types of movies that the Hollywood system makes. Mm. I love, you know, the thing about Hollywood that people often forget is it's incredibly embracing. Anybody who shows up, they want, show us what you got. Can I make a buck off you? There's nothing, you know, edifying about it or kind. It's, but show me what you got. I want you to be good. I want to make money from you. Right. And, you know, so it has been incredibly embracing of me. It's just that I have noticed the types of movies shrinking, except for a few vanity award consideration projects that they make each year. It's, you know, The Godfather was the summer blockbuster of its time.
Yeah, no, they're not as good. I mean, I was looking, actually, a lot of friends are 40 this year or whatever.
Right.
And so they said, well, what film can I show at my 40th? I'm going to hire a cinema. And I said, well, go back to 1970 or 1971, whatever, and see what was in the top 10 when you were born. And you do that and you go back. And it was, you know, amazing films. Fiddler on the Roof, The Godfather. I mean, the top 10, like, you couldn't dream of now.
The golden age of American cinema for me was the 70s. It's just extraordinary.
And you can't be in those films now. You want them to make them.
I can't. I mean, I can imagine I'm in them, but I'm not.
If, you know, you've come back, let's talk about Broken Lions, which is why, you know, you're here, which is, I think it's wonderful that you're helping promote it. I know you did it for your friends Dan Fredenberger,
yes,
and Dorothy Rosen, who I didn't know. Yeah. Before this film, actually,
yes.
To say. How did you get involved in that? How do they lure you back? Was it the promise of playing a part that is so different, and in a film that could never be made in Hollywood because it's set in Finsbury Park? I suppose they visit very often.
I don't think they've heard of Finsbury Park. I got a phone call from my best mate Dan, who said, "You know, Dorley and I have written a script, and could you do me the favour of reading it? And there's a part in there for you if you like it." And almost immediately I realized it was really him doing me a massive favor, and I said yes, because the part's just fantastic. I thought it would give me the opportunity to try to do something worthwhile again, and it was a really great experience.
And is it easy then to turn around, presumably to your people, to your agents, that I'm just going back to North London for a couple of weeks and doing, you know, boxer role?
Yes, yes. It took me 6 days, though, so they didn't really have much to say about it.
They didn't miss you.
No. I could have done it. I'm not sure they'd know I did it.
You could have got away with it.
Yeah, exactly.
But, it is a good part. It is a strong part. I mean, it's not a lead part, though, amazingly.
No, not at all. I mean, the film is about, well, it's a love story about two people who feel really trapped in their lives and their relationships, and they embark on an affair, and it's also about the consequences of that affair on them and also their partners. And I play one of those. I play Chester, who's an ex-boxer, who's struggling to come to terms with the changes in his life and his relationship post a severe stroke. And, you know, he's a man who lived almost entirely physically and now finds himself confined to his mind, and that's not a very comfortable place.
No, I mean, it's a powerful part, actually. Watching it is quite painful, I have to say, because of that battle that's going on and that rage that ends up coming out of your eyes. Haven't seen you that angry since Gangster Number One, I think. I don't know what it is about coming back to London.
Makes me furious.
Absolutely. The traffic, I can't believe it. The parking fines.
There's nowhere to park in Finsbury Park. After I said yes, I did a fair amount of research on stroke survivors. I read a couple of books, first-hand accounts of surviving a stroke, and also I got Doralee and Daniel to videotape hours and hours. They did such an amazing job of really candid interviews with people that had been through that experience. And I live in New York, so I didn't want to interview a New Yorker. I think there's a very there is a national characteristics that is a sort of stoicism I wanted the people to be English, and they were incredibly gracious and candid and very moving, and there were a myriad of responses to the predicament, but there were a few unifying things, it seemed to me, and one was a sort of fury and a anger at one's own body and a frustration at having to relearn simple things, and also a shame, a profound sense of shame surrounding feelings of dependency.
Yeah.
And I thought that would be compounded in a man whose very identity was wrapped up with this notion of being manly and finding himself stripped of that identity.
Yeah, well, it does come across, I have to say. And I what I liked about the film was its precision on its locations. I mean, it's kind of near where I live, so I kind of know it well. And in fact, I was a little bit shocked. I think it's a spoiler to see Dan and Doralee or Becca and Jake having sex on the steps of the Emirates Stadium. And I thought, clearly this wasn't shot this season, because nobody would want to have sex after watching Arsenal this year, was I thinking. But I thought it was very nice there. And in fact, it's because of the steps of which I walk up most Saturdays.
Revolting.
Well, I hope they've cleaned them, really. But it is rare to see a film actually getting so precise. I mean, we see it quite a lot in films that they get a bit vague. And I think being precise about its location and the people that live there was what really works for this film. It kind of, you know, the streets and the shops and the fusty attics, they kind of course with the ghosts of the past.
You know, and we have a sort of tradition of trying to show London at its most glamorous in a sort of what feels kind of desperate, grasping way for American.
Yeah.
No, there's the, you know.
That's what, because we used to do it gritty. I mean, going back to Naked and that kind of era.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly it seemed that, you're right, it came across that we had to kind of prettify it and make. And,
and it was always sunny suddenly in London.
Except at Christmas when it snows.
Yes, of
which,
course.
Of course, it never does. But there was that kind of, let's make it attractive. And it has sort of worked. It gave London a bit of a makeover and made it cinematic. But I'm sensing a little movement back to the kind of individualism and the kind of little areas of London.
Yeah,
and
both the writers grew up in that. In that part of town, and I think it's really imbued with their experience and their love of it.
It seems to me British cinema, European cinema, something like the success of Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, which I noticed you weren't in, given everyone else was in.
I've noticed I'm not in that as well.
get me a Furious sequel. You know, the powerhouses of European cinema seem to be rising, and artists like Lars von Trier are working here. You can come back here. You don't have to be involved in the Hollywood process. Perhaps Hollywood is, I'm not saying it's a dead town, but I'm saying that it is no longer perhaps the only place to make films in the world.
Yeah, I don't think it ever has been. But you're absolutely right that there was a dearth of movies. You know, there was nothing to make for years.
Yeah, I know.
You had to go.
And with about all the youngish actors that, you know, of which your generation, there was a period where there was more jobs for critics and presenters about film than there were actually for actors to be in.
Absolutely. And you want to work, you know, so you travel.
Yeah,
you get on your bike.
Yeah. Do you still work? Because I know that you and Jennifer shared loads for a while, that she would do a movie and you would look after the kids, yeah, and then swap positions. Yeah. Is that where you're at now? Now you've got two. You can't both work.
We've tried it a different way. We got three.
You got three? Excuse me.
Oh, we got three. We tried it a different way, and it was really hard. If you're somebody that wants to raise your own children, it's really hard to both work at the same time. So I think we're back to one-on, one-off, unless, you know, but it's a rule that can be broken if something amazing comes up.
Yeah. And would you, has having children, each one, has it impacted on your acting? Has it changed you as an artist? I'm thinking in particular.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And not in altogether good ways, you know. Some ways I think that, rightly so, they became the absolute focus of my life, and I had very little interest in making movies, and that it became solely a source of income for me, and it was enough, you know. I would go and do a job, make a bunch of dough, and then come home, and I would stay home for a year and a half, I mean, and just not work.
Wow.
And it was great. But I have since sort of found that hunger in myself again, and feel the need to you know, to satiate that, you know, need in me, and I'm going to.
Yeah. Well, I saw it.
If people employ
me. I saw it with you. Yes, exactly. I saw it in, I suppose, in the Darwin in Creation, that film. You and the monkey.
Yes, just, me and the monkey.
Yeah, it's very good monkey that you've
That's
got
great
there.
Monkey.
It's a great monkey. But you got to work with your
But
your
enough
missus.
Of my wife.
Exactly. And the ape wasn't bad either. but here all week. That's a way of doing it. You could both
just make films together.
Yeah,
they frown on that these days though, don't they? I mean, she's really good. I mean, it's quite tempting. But for some, especially in America, you know, people really frown on it in a way that they don't frown on it, say, when Monica Bellucci and
Vincent Cassell
have worked together many times.
Yeah, and they're going to do again, she said, on this show a couple of weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah.
And nobody thinks about it.
Yeah. You know? And they're quite similar to you two. You know, he's got that kind of same hair and, you know, she's dark and all that. You could just pretend to be them.
Yeah, I could. We're doing really well. Exactly.
Thank you for coming on Film Weekly, Paul Bettany. I'd like
Such
to see a lot
a
more
pleasure.
Of you.
Thank you so much.
And Broken Lines is on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 30th of September. After Paul Bettany, another beautiful mind, Zan Brooks, joins me in the studio to look at some of the week's releases. I'm being nice to you this week, Zan.
Yeah, it's changed, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. We're going to look at a film that we've been talking about for quite some time, Lars von Trier's Melancholia. Then we'll look at Helen Mirren in The Debt alongside Jessica Chastain and Tom Wilkinson. And then we can look at Kevin Smith's new film, Red State. But we'll start with Melancholia. Its premiere is this week in London. The mysterious planet Melancholia is heading towards Earth. Here are Kiefer Sutherland and Charlotte Gainsbourg trying to reassure each other.
Have you been going online again? Claire, you promised.
I'm afraid of that stupid planet.
That stupid planet? That wonderful planet, you mean? First it was black, now it's blue. Blocking Antares, hiding behind the sun. Darling, this is going to be the most amazing experience we will have in our lives. It will be here in 5 days, and it is not going to hit us. Just like it didn't hit Mercury, as we knew it wouldn't. And it didn't hit Venus, as we well knew it wouldn't. And it won't hit Earth, as we know it won't.
Now, Kiefer and Charlotte were in it. Of course, Kristen Dunst is in it, and she won Best Actress at Cannes for her role in it. Lars von Trier seems to have kind of eclipsed Melancholia himself.
Yeah, that was the kind of the great noises off at Cannes this year was that a couple of years ago, Lars von Trier came to Cannes with Antichrist and whipped up a kind of huge storm from the film itself. Melancholia, for whatever reasons, whether good or bad reasons, didn't quite have the same visceral impact. And so Lars von Trier maybe was miffed by this and so made his kind of infamous Nazi Hitler jokes in the press conference and kind of whipped up a storm there.
So let us cease to concentrate on the extraneous and look at the actual film itself. Is Melancholia the movie any good? Whether Lars von Trier is persona non grata or not, the film was still allowed to stay in competition and it's now released here. So is it a good movie? Is it a good Lars von Trier movie? Are the two the same thing?
It's a very difficult movie to get tabs on, I think, this one. This is one of the ones I came away from Cannes genuinely puzzled by my responses to it. I have to say, I think Lars von Trier is great. I think he's fascinating. I think he's possibly one of the most fascinating directors currently at work. And part of the reason of that is you never know quite what he is going to hit you with. This was a much more complicated film than maybe Antichrist or Dogville even. It's much more muted. It's much more in different stages. It's kind of layered. Maybe it doesn't quite hang together.
Yeah, you say muted, but it's also huge.
I mean, it's huge. Bombastic. It's operatic.
It's about the end of the world. Absolutely. It's a planet heading towards us.
It's
there are
all of these things.
Huge tableau at the beginning of it that are, I don't know, like amazing artistic creations and stills.
They're astonishing. And weirdly, if there's a problem that I do have with this film, and maybe it's a sort of fitting problem, is that it is a bit of a kind of dying fall. It's a winding down of a film. So you get this extraordinary opening 10 minutes of these tableaus. It's great to Wagner's overture to Tristan and Isolde with these incredibly kind of painterly great slabs up on the screen that are just astonishing and maybe pointless. Maybe it is just absolute hubris and complete over-exuberance on his part. But there's no denying that it's sort of a fantastic visual experience.
Well, you don't know what that opening is for. Where's it going to go from here? In fact, they are sort of still taken from later in the movie.
They are, yeah.
It gets stylized
renderings
too.
Of it, yeah. From there, you're pitched into a very a sort of Feston-like wedding, which is sort of, you know, full of simmering tensions and in-laws who hate each other and just all of this, which is compelling in its way.
Which you've got Stellan Skarsgård, John Hurt in there. You've got
Charlotte Rampling. And all of these kind of very poisonous people in this palatial castle kind of tearing strips of each other. And Kirsten Dunst, who's the successful sort of genius advertising copywriter who is a manic depressive, and it's a brilliant performance by her. And then from that you're pitched into this sort of end of the world chapter 3 where the planet is possibly on a collision course, they don't know, and then all of the guests are sort of stripped away and it's just Charlotte Gainsbourg, the little kid, Kirsten Dunst and Kiefer Sutherland as the husband.
I can't stop thinking of him as Jack Bauer. Every time I hear him, even in this film, I just, because he kept going, oh my God.
He seemed a little ill at ease in this film.
Yeah, I think he was
thinking,
but
maybe that's what Lars von Trier does to you. He makes you ill at ease. So it's a strange film. It's a film in these sort of chunks that maybe don't quite hang together.
Mm. I mean, I have to say that, again, I was sort of perturbed by it, moved by it, struck by it. I was also phenomenally bored by it.
Were you?
Yeah, like almost like rigid, because it's about the end of the world, and it kind of made me think, well, what would I do if it was the end of the world in that kind of way? And all this film was about what would Kirsten Dunst do if it was the end of the world? I said, you know what? I didn't care what Kirsten Dunst does.
But she comes into her own, doesn't she? I mean, this was the inspiration, supposedly, for von Trier to make this film, that having struggled with depression, his therapist apparently told him that depressives basically are happy when a crisis is coming. That's when they're at their most calm and zen and organized. So Kirsten Dunst rises to the moment, I guess,
well,
as the others
really
fall
apart. She doesn't
apart.
Save anyone. She doesn't save the world.
It's the end of the world. So
she gets a
this
serene...
This is James Bond.
Well, do something. Make someone happy. Do
you
a
wanted,
dance.
You wanted a little bomb with a timer that
she could defuse.
Could
go, ding, ding, ding. 1 second to go. That would have been exciting.
Well, you see, now you're taking against this film, I'm beginning to like it a bit more.
Good.
I did like it. I just didn't think it was top notch.
I don't like
Trier.
It anymore at all. Maybe
you've always had a bit of a problem with them.
You hated
Antichrist.
I did hate Antichrist. Well, that's because people said, "Oh, it's just a little shot of someone's, you know, clitoris being cut out." And I said, "Yeah, it's a little shot, but it takes about 6 weeks to build a rubber vulva and get. It's an effects shot. It takes ages. It's not something you just kind of throw in by mistake. You send whole departments out to create that effects. That's what he wants, you know.
Yeah,
and then people sort of say, "Oh, it's just a throwaway shot."
Oh no,
it's
certainly wasn't a throwaway shot. That was the great kind of walloping us with that. I liked Antichrist, and I quite like this, but it's second division von Trier for me.
Second division von Trier. We shall move to The Debt, Zan. This is set in Israel in 1997, but it's also set in Berlin in the 1960s. It stars Helen Mirren as Rachel and Tom Wilkinson as Stephen Gold, now a respected security minister in Israel. But he's received unsubstantiated reports that a man claiming to be from their past has resurfaced in the Ukraine.
David has taken himself out of the equation. I can't do it. You're the only one left.
Are you insane?
We can't.
Well, I can't do it. I can't. But look at me. I'm not capable. I haven't been an agent for 30 years. You're insane. No, I can't do it.
You have to do it, Rachel.
This is a film of accents and time changes, starring Helen Mirren, Jessica Chastain, who we know from The Tree of Life. This is one of her myriad films that she's got coming out.
God.
She, you know, I don't recognise her in it. She could be the same person, different people. She, I
think
never
it's
know.
Different people.
Do you think she's different people?
Yeah, I think this is a great kind of Hollywood 2.0 marketing thing. They've got like five of her.
Because she's in The Help that's coming out soon as well. I mean, she doesn't need any help, but she is sort of unrecognised.
Big Mama's House, she's in that.
She's in that. She's in The Pants and in Dr. Dolittle 5. She wears a pigeon.
She's right now.
Excellent. I love what you've done with the beard. I think to me that she's sort of best bit in it. The middle bit where they go back to Berlin and they do the Nazi hunting thing is really, really good.
Yeah, it is. It's got some great set piece scenes in this. The actual abduction where you've got the Nazi war criminal who's now a respected gynecologist, and that they kind of have to smuggle him out is really well done. And then that sort of spills over into a great scene at the train station where the guards in East Berlin are kind of guarding it. And they've got that thing where they've got like, you know, 10 seconds as the train pulls up to kind of run out and cut the wires and then run back and hide again.
And the dogs are going to look and then the searchlight's going to swoop
over.
And
all stuff. Of that is very well done. The rest of it I thought was a bit ropey.
Yeah,
a bit clunky.
Me too. I mean, we're talking about those bits of the well-handed set pieces, and then I remember it's John Madden, you know, who's obviously well known for Shakespeare in Love. See, he doesn't really do this stuff very often, the kind of adventure stuff. So I was pleased to see it, and he seemed to get that quite nicely. I did think the film rather fell down in the modern layers.
Yeah, there's a problem as well with the casting as well, isn't there? That you've got, you know, Tom Wilkerson playing the older Martin Chocas and Kieran Hines playing the older Sam Northington, and they look nothing like their younger incarnations. Mm. So that's a big imaginative leap that we're being asked to make. Then you've got this, you know, in a way it's sort of exciting, but it's also incredibly cheesy. The big denouement where Helen Mirren has to go and complete the
message.
It's
quite embarrassing. I think it's one of the worst things she's ever done. and I include Arthur in this.
Yeah. You know, without giving too much away, it's sort of pensioner violence, isn't it? Which you just think, come on.
Yeah. It doesn't quite work.
The assailant is like 90 years old.
Yeah, I'm going to have you. There could be something sweet about that. I mean, I remember like in The Boys from Brazil where Gregory Peck and Laurence Olivier had a sort of little fight kind of thing, and they were quite old by then. The problem with this for me is that I think it's trying to be brave, and I think it's sort of suggesting that, you know, that Mossad Israel did murky things and that it's part of a cover-up. So,
and that it was a bit of PR spin as
well. So that all of those films I mentioned, The Boys from Brazil, that had goodwill in the 70s, where it was all about Mossad catching Eichmann that actually has been switched on its head. So in a way, I couldn't work out whether this film was sort of trying to say something really quite controversial about, you know, Mossad being dark ops in some kind of way, or if it was saying, well, it was still heroic because the Nazis were bad. I felt
there was a definite uncertainty, and that comes together during the scenes where they have the Nazi war criminal kind of chained to the radiator and they have these conversations with him. And you think there's potentially a great film to be made just about those exchanges, but it sort of rushes past them a little bit, and you kind of want to stay with that a bit more. The other problem that I had, and this is probably wildly inappropriate, but I was thinking there should be a bit more lightness here. There should just be a bit more kind of freedom. It's as heavy as lead, this film. And, you know, maybe that's inappropriate to want a bit of lightness in a film that's about Mossad agents on the trail of a, you know, Nazi war criminal.
What do you
but
want
at the same
time,
well, you want something. This just felt like, you know, being weighed down by heavy metal.
Yeah, I think it should be, instead of being called The Debt, it might be called The Guilt, which I think is sort of similarly there, but it does weigh heavy on its shoulders. That's The Debt, starring Helen Mirren and Jessica Chastain. As another a big name is back this week, Kevin Smith, he of Clarks and Clarks 2. He is back with a film called Red State, what he wrote and what he directed and what he self-funded as well. It's got a fantastic part in it for Michael Parks as a hellfire preacher.
Is there anyone who can look at the news and deny these are our end times? Outside our fence lays a world at waste. There's famine, such as in Africa. Monsoons, typhoons, hurricanes, and the ensuing floods, such as New Orleans number one sin city. Thailand. Thousands upon thousands dead in that tsunami. I never saw the hand of God so clearly in all my born days. And the Lord's bore witness to this apostasy. Apostasy, the leaving of faith, the denying of religion, the denying of morality. He's done with it. End is nigh.
Yes, it is.
It's got Melissa Leo in it. It's got John Goodman in it. It's got kids with familiar faces in there. But what's going on in Red State, Zan?
Yeah, it's got everything but the script, hasn't it, I think, this film?
It says on the poster that Quentin Tarantino freaking loves this movie.
Yeah, which is one of those things that it will, of course, draw some people, but actually sort of repels me.
Yeah, me too.
even though I like Tarantino, but him getting behind and banging the drums.
I like Tarantino as well, but I think he's kind of a bully filmmaker because all his mates are infinitely inferior filmmakers to him.
Yeah, yeah. He's the sort of the tough kid at school who's got the kind of gang of hangers-on who he'll occasionally pat on the head. And if you laugh at one of these hangers-on, he'll come and kick your ass.
Yes.
But it actually just makes you want to laugh at them a bit more.
Yeah. So Kevin Smith, where are you on Kevin Smith? I mean, is he kind of a self-taught filmmaker, if a filmmaker at all?
I don't know. When did he teach?
I don't know. Clarks, I mean.
Clarks, but Clarks was great.
Yeah.
And Clarks was great because it was totally unschooled. But then you have to kind of progress.
Chasing Amy?
I didn't really like that.
I quite like Chasing Amy.
No. Dogma had its moments.
Mm-hmm.
Zach and Miri wasn't good. Jersey Girl wasn't good. He hasn't developed, I guess.
No.
And maybe that's his USP, that he's still the kind of, you know, the strutting adolescent who's making the movies he wants to make.
Disingenuous there. I think that, you know, it's 20-year career he had now. Clarks was 91, so it's, you know, you should get a bit better at doing it, at picking up the camera. Camp technologies have got a bit better. Presumably
weird,
he knows a
it?
Few more editors or whatever, and writers. You'd have thought he could.
So you think that this is studied idiocy?
Well, it might. Yeah, he's honing his craft of idiocy. Then it seems a bit odd that you or you're a bit thick and you haven't actually kind of got any better.
I'd go with that.
Okay.
I think that's what it is.
So
and if you've got Tarantino saying you're a freaking great man, then maybe there's no incentive to do anything
else. Yeah, it's true, except that no one's really picking his work up. He's having to self-distribute it, and he's getting a bit annoyed with critics and Harvey Weinstein and everyone. I didn't see this recently, yesterday, but at the National Press Show, apparently he filmed a to-camera plea from himself to the British critics saying, you're so much cleverer than the US critics, you're going to like this film, please be kinder to it. I didn't see the message.
Smacks of desperation a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, did you see that message?
Yeah.
Are you going to be kinder?
Not really.
I'm sure that sort of gets the hackles up before you even start.
It does. You know, I don't think it's going to work on Chris Tookie.
But he might sympathise in kind of a belly kind of situation, because they have similar physique, if nothing else.
I don't know. This, you know, I agree with the politics. By all means, make a sort of political burlesque about, you know, Republican heartland of America, and really push the envelope. But you've got to tell us something we don't know.
I've seen these people in Louis Theroux's documentary about that Baptist church that are against homosexuals, and it's about three boys who kind of go seeking sex, and they get called a honey trap by Melissa Leo of all people, and then they suddenly find themselves kind of tied up and trussed up and on a crucifix in the middle of a church, being accused of being homosexual, which in fact they're not.
Which is a fine premise.
It could have been
good.
There's a bit of Eli Roth torture porn hostile situation in that, plus the kind of hellfire preacher stuff. Then there's the outside SWAT team of John Goodman going on.
It's the sort of the sole voice of reason. And then it tips into Waco-style Siege, which just felt a little bit crass.
All very quickly, all without explanation,
without
reason.
There's no thread running through this at all, and it's just people shouting and guns going off.
And I think if you're going to criticise fundamentalism or evangelism or whatever it is, bigotry in some kind of way, then you've got you're saying something quite strict and quite sort of dangerous in a way. So say something. Yes. This movie just said nothing about why, you know, evangelism is bad.
Or just don't, but then don't call it Red State and don't have the slight pretensions that it's this great assault on that world. Do it just as a straight kind of torture porn film,
yep,
like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something, kids adrift in Texas.
Yeah, so a redneck that's horror fine kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, have it totally apolitical and just go with that. But when you're trying to make this sort of big statement, you've got to actually back it up. You've got to have a bit of nous behind it. And this is just utterly empty-headed.
So two stoners talking crap outside a convenience store. Good. Trying to take on God, religion, and the state's mechanisms. Bad.
See, if they'd done it in Clarks, I'd probably have gone along with it, but not here.
Kevin Smith's Red State brings to a close our look at the week's big releases. Thank you, Zan, as ever. For all of Zan's real reviews and his musings on the world of film, go to the best film site on the web, www.guardian.co.uk/film. And that is all for this week. Before we go, we have to announce the winner of our Drive competition. We asked you, which Cannes-winning film did Cliff Martinez score? Cliff, of course, scored the excellent Drive soundtrack that we featured on last week's show. And the answer for his other Cannes hit was, of course, Sex, Lies and Videotape, which won for Steven Soderbergh in 1989. Well, we had loads of entries, so we need to pick a name out of the proverbial hat. And we'll see what we've come up with. And the winner of the driving gloves and of the soundtrack and of the original novel by James Salis, upon which the screenplay for Drive was based, is Jacob Zetterholm. He says, Sex, Lies, Videotape is the answer, Jason, to the Drive competition. I've been a huge fan of Nicholas Winding Refn since Pusher, and I live close to Copenhagen, so I can actually give him a lift wearing those gloves if I win. Well, for that weirdness, Jacob, congratulations, and they are on their way to you in a very fast car. The music we've been featuring on this edition is the score to Helen Mirren's The Debt by Thomas Newman, whose previous scores, of course, include Jarhead and Wall-E, not to mention the theme to 6 Feet Under and American Beauty. Remember, if you want the best accompaniment to a Sunday brunch, pick up The Observer for trailer trash and the best film reviews and news. Until next week, when I'll be joined by Paddy Considine and Olivia Colman, it's me, Jason Solomons, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps saying goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.